Hello everyone and welcome back to the Computer Vision in Production podcast show. The podcast show where we talk all about everything computer vision, from the individual components of the technology including vision, cameras and deep learning, right through to hearing about some of the most interesting applications that companies are using at the moment. Hello everyone and welcome to the Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest is Marcus Oberweger, who is the Senior Computer Vision and Machine Learning Engineer with Naked Labs. Marcus has got a strong background coming from computer vision and actually done his PhD focusing on computer vision and machine learning from GRASS. Marcus, great to have you on the podcast at long last after rescheduling through illness that thankfully wasn't COVID.
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. Thanks for a nice introduction and thanks for having me on your podcast.
No, always interested in speaking to really good people. I mean, look, you've done some amazing things, right? I know we spoke before about some of the stuff you've done. It's just quite exciting. But look, for those people that don't know you, haven't heard of you, haven't had the luxury of speaking to you the way I have, why don't you kind of give them a little bit of an overview of your background and, you know, what you've done to date when it comes to computer vision?
Sure thing. So as you have already said, I'm currently with Naked Labs. So I joined almost or more than 2 years ago as a senior computer vision and machine learning engineer. And I'm working on different topics of computer vision related stuff, mostly on non-rigid reconstruction. So specifically, I am responsible for the machine learning and deep learning pipelines that provide the machine learning models which extract the different informations and provide it to the downstream processing. So regarding the experience I have, so actually I started with computer vision more than 10 years ago during my undergrad. So I did a lot of signal processing stuff and I figured out, hey, image processing is a special case of 2D signal processing. So this was kind of a close choice for me. So I continued with my master's in computer vision and signal processing and later did my PhD in computer science, where I focused on computer vision and machine learning. So actually, this was some years ago already, and these were very interesting times when there was this switch happening from the classical computer vision to this deep computer vision, where everything is happening with deep neural networks and this kind of stuff. So back then, everyone started using neural networks for every task possible, and also even for stuff that didn't make sense back then. But when I did my PhD, you had to have some deep neural network in your paper to get it published.
You really had to be on trend, right?
Exactly, yes. So, and I also experienced different areas within computer vision. So at university, I worked around 5 years as a researcher. I published different papers on pose estimation, for example, rigid pose estimation of objects, or non-rigid pose estimation of human bodies and this kind of stuff. Also some human-computer interaction models when a human hand, for example, interacts with an object and manipulates it. So how can we estimate the poses of the hands and the objects? How can we interact in virtual reality, for example? And also working a lot with depth cameras. They are focused on domain adaptation, for example, managing to align the synthetic and the real data, and also doing some large-scale numerical optimization. So I also worked more than 5 years in academia, where I started as a teaching assistant and later turned into a teaching associate. I taught different courses on computer vision, machine learning topics. And the funny thing is that I was managing also assignments for large-scale courses of more than 500 students. And back then, it was pretty annoying, I have to say, managing all this stuff. But nowadays, it really helps having this experience in large-scale evaluations. And also nowadays, I learned back then, you have to automatize everything possible so you can have a large throughput, for example. And my experience in the industrial field also started more than 10 years ago. I was working in industrial computer vision in the area of Industry 4.0 for Bosch, for example, then did classical computer vision at Siemens. And recent years, I was working with Qualcomm and Facebook on different machine learning topics for computer vision. So that's actually now the stuff that's relevant these days.
What was the stuff you were working on with Facebook and Qualcomm? I appreciate it was 5 years ago, but I'd always be quite conscious and believing that, you know, it's got to be high-tech stuff, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, back then it was super secret stuff. And nowadays you see that the concept that were in development back then are starting to tickle into the production and also tickle into products. So that's actually very interesting to see how far they are internally and how far they are on the product side.
So then that obviously takes us a little bit up more to your current situation, Naked Labs, very much the way you described yourself. Not everyone might not know who Naked Labs are. Why don't you give us a bit of an introduction into Naked Labs and your product?
Yeah, sure. So what we have currently available is our first generation 3D body scanner, which is kind of an ordinary mirror where some depth cameras are attached to the side. And on the back side of this mirror, there is a compute unit attached. So what you can do is you can step in front of the mirror and get a 3D scan of yourself. So how does this work? So this product has a small turntable where the user steps on and this turntable rotates in front of the mirror. And while rotating, the depth cameras, they record a video, and this video is then processed in order to generate a high-resolution avatar, which is kind of a 3D scan of the user in front of it. So what we have in there is we have three depth cameras inside the mirror, which provide the 3D point cloud data, more or less. So the problem was back then that we had to use three cameras because of the small field of view that was available back then. But then the 3D point cloud data gets processed using our computer vision algorithms. And in the back end, it's doing kind of a rigid reconstruction by fusing the different depth videos together. So all this computation is done on the device, so on the back of the mirror. And this is especially favorable with all this GDPR stuff going on. So actually no video or so leaves the device.
Pretty and cool, yeah.
In the end then, yes, the avatar, which is kind of this scanning, is visualized on your smartphone or on your tablet. And in the first stage and in the current product, we are focusing on fitness applications. And on your smartphone, you can view your weight and body composition, body fat, and keep track of your personal development in terms of different visualizations. So you can check if going to gym actually works out for you favorably, or if you're doing something wrong and the body fat increases or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, look, obviously there's a lot of other stuff you can do. Do you deliver sort of plans around that, fitness plans, or is it just very much so you look at the body, the measurements?
Yeah, so we started with this fitness focus, but of course there are endless opportunities and other applications that are possible once you have this 3D avatar.
Yeah,
so for example, you can use it in the apparel industry for customized clothing. So as you mentioned, you can do these measurements, for example, automatically. So we also had discussions with the health industry that require some tracking of body measurements and body features for after surgery and monitoring the health of the patients. But also we have seen applications in the sports industry, for example, where you could do like custom bike fitting using the automatic body measurements and this kind of stuff.
I know I used to work in a shop that sold fitness runners for distance runners, and they used to do the foot gateway And it obviously depended on how you ran, and that depended on how your body structure was, your body size in many cases as well. But no, there's a lot of cool stuff there. And I want to get down to one key point that you mentioned as well, but I don't want to just jump into it now. I want to sort of let it flow into the conversation. It's about the running the model on the edge device. But look, it's something I'm going to really pick up on then. But before we get into it, I mean, you've been with Naked Labs quite some time. Maybe I'm wrong, but you're definitely one of their first engineers, right, in vision.
So not the first in vision, actually. So they were working on the Gen 1, on the product that I just described, and I joined in for the development of the next generation body scanner, essentially.
So, yes. Yeah, so, I mean, what I'd like to know is, you know, how do you bring something like this into production? Because it's obviously quite a complex product. And then it's also user running it on the edge device. So if we talk about, you know, the sort of bring it into production first, and then if we talk about, you know, the running it on an edge device, which is even more complicated, it obviously means you have a very high performing algorithm to base it off then too.
Yes. So what I can tell you about is now how we are approaching this problem that you were mentioning on our next generation body scanner. So I was there from the beginning of the initial research, and this was actually a very exciting opportunity. So we had to design the new reconstruction pipeline from scratch. And what we are planning here at the higher level is just as a natural extension of our current product, which would be to remove the turntable and to scan the people freely by moving in front of the mirror. So this has a few advantages, for example, by requiring a smaller space for putting the device, and there are less moving parts on the mechanical side, which is advantageous. And also this is a more natural interaction of the user with the device. But on the other hand, this is much more difficult from the technical perspective. So in the first generation scanner, we were using the classical computer vision, and in the new pipeline, we have to resort to machine learning and deep learning algorithms in order to solve this much harder problem. So, and that's where I came into play there. So the major planning step was setting up these pipelines, and we had to identify the things that could be done using machine learning and also which things that are better done with classical computer vision. And we had to draw this line in between and separate the different stuff there. So actually, we used then in the end a combination of machine learning and classical computer vision. And we mostly focus on using machine learning to extract semantic information from the images or the 3D data. So this can be classical classification and regression tasks. So, for example, as a classification task, we use segmentation, foreground-background segmentation, or semantic body part parsing. For regression tasks, you can imagine, for example, pose or skeleton estimation or parameter estimation of a possible body model. So we started there, and we had to draw this line between machine learning and classical stuff, which was the most hardest part, I think. Now, coming back to your second question about the inference on the edge device, which is especially challenging if you think of the newest developments on the machine learning side, where you usually have a huge GPU available, and all the most significant research goes into the GPU inference, which assumes always better, faster, and stronger hardware, essentially. But the problem is that we do not have this available on the edge device. We have different challenges, which are the memory, the computing performance, the runtime, because ideally all this machine learning stuff should run in real time so we can apply it directly on the video feed, for example. And what we have available at our edge devices is usually just, in the best case, a multi-core CPU with a few gigabytes of RAM. And GPU would be too expensive, and require too much power. And essentially it would idle most of the time because we only need it for a small fraction of the whole processing. Now designing the algorithms or the machine learning algorithms for this part already starts with the most basic thing is with selecting the image resolution that we require. So if you have a very nice interplay between the machine learning stuff and the classical geometric stuff, you can simply start with a lower resolution and still things will be fine. And by running on a much lower resolution, you can save lots of time. And then it goes further into designing the different building blocks of the neural networks. Like the convolutions are the most expensive part there. And from the academic field, there are many tricks available that we can apply. For example, using depthwise convolutions or separable convolutions. And also some specific architectures actually perform better on CPU than on GPUs in our experience.
Yeah. And you touched on another topic there about optimizing the model's performance depending on, you know, the particular platform that it's running on. You know, those techniques, you know, like pruning, model quantization, distillation, they're quite new. Where did you become aware of that? Or where did you even say, do you know what? These topics are something we've heard about, because I would say there's very few companies that are even aware of those techniques when they could actually be using them.
Well, of course, they can give a huge benefit for the runtime and also for the memory footprint. And if you follow the latest research in the academic field, you know that's already out there for some while.
Yeah.
And in the recent years, I have to say, the support of the inference pipelines, like for example TensorFlow Lite or OpenVINO from Intel, so they significantly improved the support of functionality that they have built in there. From the research side, they provide the algorithms, but it usually doesn't pay off to implement all the inference pipeline by yourself, because that would be a huge work effort. But when I started more than 2 years ago, this support was really bad, but now it's significantly improved. And there are options readily available that can handle that stuff during training and also then during inference.
Nice. And then obviously the way you are even doing things at Naked Labs is obviously very close to what's in the research, because you mentioned previously to this that if I remember correctly, you have built your models on synthetic data, right? So all your pre-trained models wouldn't even be breaching GDPR anyway, even if they were ever to go off-site, as opposed to the one that actually runs on the device, if that ever went to cloud, right?
No. So, I mean, all the data we use for training is all synthetic only. So that's compliant with every GDPR, so because that's no real person in the end.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I mean, obviously that's a big decision. And I've spoken with many other companies who, not necessarily in the same domain as you, but, you know, are really much in the 3D human computer vision technologies, where they're working on these edge cases of humans. And their biggest challenge is getting access to data. Mm-hmm. You have obviously beat that by going down the road of synthetic data. Again, like, What drove that decision in the business? Because it's obviously, it's quite comprehensive, you know, to come in and create a data set based off GANs. It can be quite useful. But again, it's something that I don't see a lot of companies doing, but I know how powerful it can be to a business.
Yes. So we decided very early to go the path of using synthetic data only, and it was mainly driven by our R&D process. So we were in the beginning evaluating different cameras, and each camera has different characteristics. And for example, you compare time of flight cameras with structured light, though they all have different noise patterns, different behavior. And quickly adjusting to different cameras can be pretty hard. So you have to consider the cost of data collection and also data annotation. And in between, it takes a lot of time. So the throughput between the data capture and then getting back the annotated samples can usually become the bottleneck if you do a rapid iteration there. So, and by choosing to use synthetic data, we have the advantage that we can create almost unlimited data in this at the press of a button, essentially.
Yeah. But
on the drawback side, there are also different challenges involved. So you need to model the camera noise characteristics. And there is also this inherent domain gap between the real and the synthetic data. And this domain gap is also an unsolved problem in academic research. So that's really a hard nut to crack. Since you mentioned GANs before, I mean, lots of companies do that. I'm aware of that. In my personal experience, that's actually not accurate enough for us. So the GANs, they exhibit the different specificities in terms of noise they introduce. Also, they are hard to train. So we also did some initial experiments with GANs. But in the end, the accuracy that we can achieve on the images that are generated, they are not sufficient for the accuracy that we require for our 3D reconstructions.
I mean, it's funny you say that because I've also quite familiar with the website domain thispersondoesnotexist.com, right? And it's just all it's humans generated by GANs, and we know obviously. Not every picture even looks like a person, right? It's quite insane. So how do you create the synthetic data set? Is it something that you model itself or yourselves to kind of get different pieces of information or to make it look right?
So essentially we apply for generating this synthetic data, a multi-stage pipeline. So the first step is a domain randomization step. The second step is then a noise modeling step, and the last step is then the domain adaptation or closing the synthetic real gap. So domain randomization also comes from the academic field where you simply try to get more diverse data generation. And in the first place, it doesn't have to be very realistic. So you just try to have lots of variations. And in our case, we try to model different scenes, different backgrounds, different random body models, and put this all together. So in the end, no image looks like another image. So this is the first step. So we have a huge variety of different training images, for example. Then the second step is this noise modeling where we try to match the camera noise. So what we have done so far is we have based this on different heuristics that we implemented, and it turned out to work reasonably well in our pipeline. But I believe there can be also something done in a data-driven way to learn this camera-specific noise. But again, you would have to resort to kind of a GAN stuff in the end, which is, as far as I can say now, not accurate enough. So we are talking here in the millimeter range or submillimeter range that we require for our reconstruction pipelines. And when you look, and as you mentioned, the GANs from this person images, so yeah. They usually have some high frequency noise overlaid, which is not visible by the human eye, but it's there. And if we use the raw data for our pipelines, it can create strange artifacts in the end. So that's kind of a very deep problem. But the academic research is working on fixing that. And I think soon we can also use that for the noise modeling step. And the last part is essentially the domain adaptation. So where we mitigate the difference in the statistics between the synthetic and the real images. This is also an unsolved problem in academia. But since we do this in the last step of our pipeline, it's much simpler due to all these pre-processing steps that are applied to the synthetic data. So what things that come here to our mind is you can use adversarial training, so similar to GANs, but not on the image level. So you're not generating images, but you're aligning the features that are generated, and also doing a statistical matching of the different features. So this works better in the end than applying it on the raw images. And the most important thing is you have to put in many, many, many noise and injecting randomness in every part of this pipeline in order that the network cannot overfit. Otherwise, you really suffer from this domain gap and it won't perform well on the real data.
So I suppose, you know, I'm quite interested in getting your views on, you know, sort of the 3D technology breakdown, because obviously it's a huge part of your product, but I'm also considering your data sets are created completely synthetically, wondering how that goes in. So I suppose if you are building your 3D models, you know, obviously you have to look at the modeling of the faces, the bodies, the model inferencing, mm-hmm. you know, how does that, or does that even change with a synthetic data set?
Yes, of course. I mean, that's a very significant part of our work that you were mentioning, since from the scanner, we get the raw avatar scans or the raw scans, which are meshes, but these meshes, they do not have any consistent topology, and the surfaces are usually unevenly connected. So a body model or a statistical body model gives an interesting or an useful way to standardize these avatars and these input meshes, and that makes all this downstream processing much simpler and faster. And by using such standardized models, it also gives rise to apply machine learning models on such standardized input data. What you can think of, there are many popular models like this. For example, from the Max Planck Institute, there is SMPL and STAR model, which are very famous. Or from Google, they have also recently presented their own model. And there are also some models available which are community-driven, like the MakeHuman, for example. So we investigated and looked at different models that are available, but given our constraints, we were not really 100% happy with that what's available. And in the end, we had also to design or adjust available models to match our requirements. Now we have the model available and we get the scans in. We have to fit these models to the scans. And as you mentioned, like modeling the face and the body such that it matches between the scan and the statistical body model. This matching is also not that easy, and we resort to a joint machine learning and geometric optimization again. So it has turned out that the machine learning initialization works pretty well to get an initial clue for the parameters of the pose and the shape of this model, and for fine-tuning then the parameters of the model with respect to the input mesh, we resort to a geometric optimization scheme. And in the end, it gives highly accurate fitted models where we are in the millimeter range of accuracy. So that's working pretty nicely.
And then obviously, you know, looking at it then as well, if again, because you're using synthetic data, how different is this? But, you know, looking obviously at the edge cases, or maybe it's even something that you have to still train your model to be quite accurate on, because these are obviously looking for accurate readings of someone's, you know, hip size at distance to distance. You know, how do you look at that when you're building a model and getting, you know, as close to the human edge as possible for an accurate reading?
Yes, I mean, that's always difficult to get the correct edges. For example, as you mentioned, like the torso with respect to the thighs, or the hair versus the background and so on. So since we are using depth sensors, there is always a limited resolution inherent. So, for example, we cannot resolve a single hair strain, for example, because it's very tiny and it's moving non-rigidly. So here we try to teach the user and tell them that they should tie their hair backwards, for example, because otherwise it would create artifacts in the scanner or in the depth sensor first, then artifacts in the reconstruction, and then also artifacts in the fitted body models. So it's much simpler to focus on the face, where we have features that can be identified by the user, and we focus less on the hair. By focusing on the face, for example, the user can still recognize himself. And it's also much simpler to handle that on the model side. As you have said, it's difficult for the exact measurements. And for this, we rely on a good registration of the underlying body model with respect to the scan, and have kind of a hybrid solution to do the exact measurements. So they are much more repeatable by relying on the geometry, which is more stable from the body model.
Nice. That's really, really good. Again, it's difficult to say because I don't know how still yous need to be when doing it, or, you know, if people have to move their arms, but do yous ever have to, like, you know, parameterize the body models of like a moving person, or is everyone still when they're getting their measurements taken, I guess?
Yeah, so actually that's a very tough problem that you were mentioning, because during the scan, the user usually rotates and it's not perfectly still. And one can account for that using the pose parameters of the body shape. So during this movement in front of the camera, so one parameter, which is the shape, usually stays constant, and only the pose is moving, the pose is changing, which corresponds to the moving object or the moving person. And one can simply pose this as a tracking problem and track the person in front of the camera. And by accurately tracking the person movements, you can factor out these moving arms, because everything maps back then to the canonical body model that is tracked.
Lovely. That's really, really cool stuff. And I know, again, from speaking with, as I said, these other companies who are using similar technologies, but they actually focus around the movement of the body, you know, getting the edge cases when people are moving, you know, even if it's, let's say, for example, a woman whose hair is over their shoulders, right? It can, it's a very difficult reading to get, right?
Yes, so that's very difficult. And especially, as I mentioned, from a depth camera, so usually the resolution is not good enough to observe that at all. So we usually resort to instructing the users just to avoid surprises during the reconstruction. Because if the hair is open, it moves non-rigidly, it can appear and disappear during the rotation. Doing a reconstruction of the hair from the depth images at this resolution is really, really tough. So I think for that purpose, using color images could even work better.
Yeah. I know there was a topic you mentioned to me, which, you know, was quite new that I'd not actually heard of before. Quite interested in asking about it. It was, I'm assuming, because you seem to be so... Naked Labs are very close to what's in research, right? This is quite a cutting edge research topic, is geometric deep learning.
Yes, so actually that's pretty interesting and a new one. So we at our company, we deal with 3D data, which comes from the depth sensor. So we have, for example, 3D point clouds, and this naturally gives rise to this geometric deep learning. So essentially this is a very recent topic that appeared a few years ago in the research, and there have been seminal works there. So for the research affine guys, PointNet, for example, or spectral mesh convolutions are some keywords that appear. And it's, from my perspective, it's a more natural representation for the 3D data to use them really as 3D points and to process them as 3D points, rather than to use artificial 2D projections such as images, because an image is kind of a 3D a 3D to 2D projection of the real world. So using the 3D data as real 3D data, I think, is a more natural representation. There are essentially two branches that we are investigating within this geometric deep learning. So the first is that we can use the 3D point clouds that come from the depth cameras. We can use them directly and using point-based geometric deep learning. For example, this point net that I mentioned earlier is representative of that family. And as a second path that can be explored is to use mesh-based deep learning, since our user scans or our avatars, they also meshes, so we can apply this technology as well. So what's the difference? So for meshes, we also have explicit information about the connectivity of the points. More or less, we have information about the surface. And using that, this works nicely with the body models, for example, where we get automatically 3D surface. So we also use this technology for various purposes, like as pose estimation and semantic segmentation and this kind of stuff. And what I've seen so far, this turns out to work pretty nicely. These models are especially well suited for mobile or edge computing, because they require less computation. They provide faster inference, and especially on CPUs. But in terms of accuracy, I personally feel that there is still a small gap to close when comparing it to standard image-based deep learning approaches.
And then obviously, I know we touched on it briefly, but I did want to ask one final question about it, real specific to it. On the edge computing, the edge inferencing, you spoke about obviously the models that you're working on. You spoke about the technologies that you are using. Where does it go? What would you advise someone if they say, perfect, we want to put something, we've got this model, it works, maybe we've got a Raspberry Pi, but we want to put it on an edge device. We want to bring in a GPU or a CPU. How would you look at what type of hardware to provide and how to make that type of selection?
So if I answer correctly, like, how would you do a hardware selection on an edge device, right?
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing. It strongly depends on the requirements that you have in terms of speed and in terms of image resolution, and of course about the task. So if you can boil down the task and make it a little bit error tolerant, that's always much simpler, because then you put less effort on the neural network model, and you can use a lightweight version of that. But one thing that's also closely interwoven with the hardware selection is then the selection of the inference platform. Because, for example, when you use an Intel CPU and Intel platform, there is OpenVINO, for example, available. Or on ARM platforms, the TVM can be very helpful, which is a framework to also optimize the layout, how the neural network operations are laying out on the different hardware cores, or if you have just a very general base or general hardware, you can use TensorFlow Lite, for example.
Yeah.
But in the end, how to select the hardware, you have to take care that you have enough memory to have at least the model available in the memory and also the intermediary results and the images. So there is kind of an I/O boundness, which involves loading the stuff to memory and then saving it back to hard drive. And I personally recommend to use some multiple core platforms. So they usually help parallelizing, especially the convolutions, which significantly speed up the stuff and also helps to interact between the live camera feed, for example, which runs on one core, and another few cores ideally that handle the neural network model inference. If you can write stuff on the wish list, then you could also hope for specific chipset instructions, for example, that can aid the model inference. such as AVX vector instructions, for example, or dedicated course for machine learning, which are also available in recent architectures.
Excellent. No, look, that's really good, really insightful. Yeah, Marcus, look, thank you for doing this episode. It was fantastic to get your input on synthetic data, 3D technologies, and of course, edge computing models. It's been fantastic speaking with you. Yes, so for everyone listening, this was your episode of Computer Vision in Production. Today's guest was Marcus Oberweger, who is a senior computer vision and machine learning engineer with Naked Labs. Marcus, it was great to have you on the show.
Yes, thanks, Anthony, for the great conversation we had, and it was a pleasure to chat with you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Computer Vision in Production podcast with your host, Anthony Kelly. To make sure you get updates on the latest episodes of the show, make sure you subscribe on your preferred podcast listening app or add me on LinkedIn.